Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. 50 years ago this week, the chairman of the Federal Communications Commission famously called American television a vast wasteland. What would he say now? We are a decade into the age of reality TV, deep enough in that all kinds of serious thinkers are thinking about what it's telling us. This hour on Point, we're listening for the deep reveal in reality television. You can join the conversation. Real Housewives, Teen Moms, Extreme Makeover, American Idol, Survivor. What do they tell us about our culture, ourselves? You can comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. We will hear today from a scholar of Victorian literature who compares today's reception of reality TV to 19th century shock and delight at the novel, and we'll hear from a feminist media critic. But first, joining me now from New York is Khalifa Sane. He is staff writer for The New Yorker magazine. His big article, The Reality Principle, The Rise and Rise of a Television Genre, came out last week. Khalifa, welcome. Thanks very much for being with us.
Thanks for inviting me. I'm always glad to have a chance to reclassify my TV watching as research.
Right, there you are. Pretty good trick. Listen, we when you write, we read. You're terrific. And here you come in on a frontier we didn't, I didn't expect to see your byline on this. But you start right off and kind of grab our attention, referring all the way back to 1973 and the great anthropologist Margaret Mead, who was famous, of course, decades earlier for her work with all kinds of anthropology around the world, South Pacific, and you name it. And here she is, you remind us, writing in the back of the TV guide, kind of a low profile, that the very first example of what we now call reality TV, the show called An American Family, is a new art form. What was this great anthropologist anticipating?
Well, I should note partly that this essay was a bit of log rolling. She had worked with some of these producers on her own work, and so she was kind of supporting them in their next endeavor.
Oh, geez. Okay. It's just promotion. Are you kidding?
in the world of television, yes, we're shocked.
Shocked.
And she saw in this show, and I think saw quite rightly, that this show didn't quite fit into any of the existing genres that we had, and that, mm-hmm. that it was a documentary that kind of unfolded serially with cliffhangers and big moments, and so it had the rhythms of something slightly different. And I think she was prescient in saying, this is a new kind of something, and we don't really have a word for it yet.
As significant, she wrote then, as the invention of drama or the novel. Here's a little bit from that PBS program. It was called An American Family. It could be considered the first of the genre we now call reality TV. 12-episode series aired in 1973, showed the lives of Bill and Pat Loud and their 5 children in Santa Barbara, California. Here's a little bit where Bill returns from a business trip one day and Pat asks for a divorce.
I have spoken to a lawyer, and this is his card. He would like to have you get in touch with him.
Okay.
And I'd like to have you move out. It's just like that.
Well, that's a fair deal.
I figured you'd think that.
I think it's short-sighted on your part, really.
And there it was, right on TV. Now, Margaret Mead knew a lot about observing cultures, Khalifa, and she knew how the observer could change the culture. No less a TV camera with a national audience, no less. I mean, did she say anything about that when she said we've got a new art form here? Are we really observing the culture, or are we, demonstrating it somehow, or even making it up?
I think anyone who's done that kind of field research knows that the change often kind of goes both ways. And just as having the camera crew there kind of distorted the lives of the Louds, so did the way the Louds kind of talk to each other influence decades later the way we think about this. In other words, when that moment when Pat says, "I'd like you to move out," mm-hmm. and Bill says, that's a fair deal. Yeah. I mean, it's an amazing line of dialogue that you wouldn't, it's kind of strange, it's kind of ambiguous, it rings true somehow. And I think that's the spirit of reality TV that still echoes. I mean, HBO recently broadcast, a feature film based on an American Family called Cinema Verite, you know, with James Gandolfini and Diane Lane.
Right.
And they kind of reenact all these scenes and you know, they give it this big juicy narrative arc and they imply that the producer is having an affair with the wife. But to me, the most powerful part of that HBO film was the moment at the end when the Loud family and the producer are on the Dick Cavett show, mm-hmm. and they're kind of talking about this. And you can see that all these emotions and the way they feel are kind of unresolved and they're sort of still processing it. And to me, one of the things that's kind of powerful about reality TV is that it tends to leave things unresolved. And even when the show tries to kind of wrap up at the end of the season or the end of the episode, the characters live on and sometimes talk back.
Is that because everybody is posing, because the cameras are there? I mean, when Bill Loud, she says, "I want you to move out." And he says, "Oh, that's a fair deal." Kind of casually, a throwaway line. Is that macho posing for the PBS camera there?
Well, I mean, partly. I think the more unsettling question is, aren't we all posing in our lives all the time? And especially when he follows it up by saying, "It's short-sighted of you." I mean, again, that mixture of, "Oh, it's no big deal. I can't quite express this. I am expressing this." I mean, again, you see all those things there at once. And you know, again, I think that does, even though the cameras obviously affect the way they interact, I think it also does reflect something of the way we talk, which is one reason why anthropologists would be interested to see the difference in dialogue between that kind of representation and a scripted representation of a marriage breaking up, which would probably proceed a lot differently.
The title of your Big New Yorker piece is not the rise and fall of a television genre, but the rise and rise of reality TV. Where are we in this arc or this trajectory? Maybe arc's not even the right word. It implies some, you know, rise and decline.
Well, it's funny. For so long, An American Family seemed kind of anomalous. There were a couple shows here and there, but it didn't really coalesce, you know, until, you know, first in the early 90s and the rise of The Real World on MTV, which was a kind of artificial analog of An American Family. Instead of going in to document what's supposed to be a real family, the camera crew creates a fake family, creates a bunch of young people, sticks them together in a house, and films them. And I think that level of artifice came to be one of the important building blocks of reality TV. And there's a sensibility throughout a show like The Real World that because the producers have stuck us together here in a house, we must be here to learn something, even if we don't know exactly what that is. And that quest to figure out what the story is, with the producers sort of molding events to give you one story and the characters sometimes going along with that plan and sometimes diverting from it, is one of the hallmarks of the genre, I think.
Who gave the genre this name, reality TV? Because, of course, everybody balks at that and says, yeah, real, like, you know, like nothing is real.
Yeah, makes me wonder if it's a provocation. Certainly, when they call the real world, there is this idea of, you know, what happens when people start getting real. But there was a little bit of tongue-in-cheek. The producers always put a fishbowl in the house as a kind of as a metaphor for what was going on. And again, the fact that these people were in a house in the first place was clearly not quite real. That said, one of the things that we discovered on a show like The Real World is that in a lot of ways, these people on the show were often less squeamish about touchy subjects than a bunch of writers who were creating characters in a room might have been. So when they had these knockdown, drag-out arguments about race and gender and all these other things, and that, again, were often left kind of unsettled and unsettling.
You might think it would propel society forward. I don't know about that. Many people say it would go back or down. It's been around long enough.
The difference between forward and backward can often be hard to discern.
Yes. But it's been around long enough in enough volume now that there is a big range of serious thinking about it out there.
Yeah.
You've talked with some of those people. We're going to have some of them on with you in just a moment. But give us a sense of the range of, you know, how are, I don't know, serious thinkers looking at reality TV in 2011?
Well, part of why I wrote this essay was that, you know, again, after we were now more than 10 years into, you know, in 2000 was the moment when it kind of really started to take over the network and cable schedules. And so we're more than 10 years into the prime, the golden age, if you will, of reality TV. And And it was interesting to me that there is a really wide range of thinkers who were trying to tackle some of these issues. You know, Jennifer Posner, who will join us, I think, soon.
In a moment, yeah.
Has really interesting things to say about the way that these shows often are built upon kind of humiliating or hurting their female contestants and kind of reinforcing social narratives of race and class. Brenda Weber has done some really interesting work on makeover shows and what that says about the way we view bodies and our power to and powerlessness to change our bodies. And you know, there's also analyses of these shows that take into account class and the fact that these are new and kind of strange financial systems, right? Often the characters on the show are always working, even though they're often portraying lives that are sort of related somehow to leisure. So you're watching a bunch of young people who seem to be goofing off, but precisely because there are cameras, they're always at work. And in that sense, reality TV and the rise of reality TV echoes the sort of creeping takeover of our lives by work and our creeping sense that we're always at work and there's nothing that we do that can't somehow be considered work.
And then you're quoting Mark Andrejevich here talking about, quoting Walter Benjamin, saying, you know, how new things take us into our past. They take us maybe even into our past.
Yeah, and there's a deep sense of nostalgia in a lot of these shows. I mean, his book was published, I think, in 2004. It was really an early book on the subject, and he kind of talks about how Survivor, which transplants these contestants into kind of jungly environments, kind of takes the law of the jungle and sort of tries to make that literal and tries to take the law of the market and the law of the jungle and somehow fuse them.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. From Survivor to Extreme Makeover to American Idol and Teen Mom, we're talking today about what reality, so-called TV, tells us about ourselves and our culture. Trademark of the popular ABC program The Bachelor is the departures of the distraught women who are rejected. Here's a teary Ashley after she did not get that rose on a date with Bachelor Brad.
No, I just really didn't think I'd go home this soon. And it just felt like someone just punched me in the stomach and the heart. I've been with certain guys in relationships, and then at the end of it, they don't want to be with you. It just makes you feel like something is wrong with you.
Think it doesn't matter? It's punched in the stomach and the heart. Here's somebody who might disagree.
The line between entertainment and politics has blurred, and so reality TV is seeping into how we think about our politics.
President Obama last week on Oprah, no less, maybe a kind of reality TV show in itself. Kelly Fasane is with us today, staff writer for The New Yorker. Big article in the most recent, I guess the issue last week was the reality principle, the rise and rise of a television genre. You can link to it at our website at On Point Radio. With us as well now, and we're glad you're there, Kelly, in New York. With us also, Jennifer Posner. She's a feminist media critic, author of Reality Bites Back, The Troubling Truth About Guilty Pleasure TV, executive director of Women in Media and News. Jennifer Posner, thank you very much for being with us today.
Hi, Tom. Thank you.
And with us from Bloomington, Indiana, is Brenda Weber, professor of gender studies at Indiana University, author of Makeover TV, Selfhood, Citizenship, and Celebrity. She's currently editing a new volume with a lot of contributors called Gender Vision, Gender and Reality TV in a transnational context, global, no less. Brenda Weber, thank you very much for being with us.
Thanks. It's a pleasure to be here.
First to you, if I may, Brenda, because I know you've got a specialty in Victorian-era fiction. And I've read, thanks to Kelifa, you looking at reality TV and being reminded of the way people were upset by novels when they first hit the culture in a big way in the 19th century. What's the parallel there, Brenda?
Yeah, it's a dirty secret that I'm a trained Victorianist now working in reality television. When the novel first started emerging in the 18th century, it was a combination of a lot of different genres. And because of its contents and because it was a new art form, it was threatening both to a sense of the cultural hierarchy, but also because of its popularity, particularly among women, it took on all of these connotations of being confusing. It would lead women to have unfair expectations about how people should behave. There was a sense that they were learning how to behave based on novels, and so that issue of authenticity was at risk. The tears that we just heard from the Bachelor clip are just permeating 19th century sentimental fiction, and it was a way of creating hierarchies based on affective content. So the novel actually, in a lot of ways, both in terms of its content but also its distribution, had all of these metaphors attached to it. So we just heard President Obama talking about reality TV seeping into politics. But seeping is a really wonderful metaphor because it suggests a form of toxic exposure or something out of its bounds, a kind of flood, you know, moving into a place where it doesn't belong, which actually is very much similar to how in 1899 Bram Stoker imagined Dracula, right, as this foreign invader moving into England, of feeding on us at night, that there are all these issues of the body that was at risk, of homoeroticism that's embedded in the vampire figure. So
what was the novel that we all now the kind of laud and praise? Was it seen as debauching the culture, the way many people look at reality TV?
Well, some of them were, yes. So if you want to go back, you know, to the earlier novels from the 18th century, very big cultural producers like Fanny Burney wrote a book called Evelina. And that was very much at the moment considered to be not to be read. The things that we think of as more staid and conventional and the great books now, works by Dickens or George Eliot, those weren't so much considered to be, you know, this horrible art form because by then we're 100 years into the genre.
Right.
But we do have hugely popular texts. For instance, Susan Warner, American novelist, wrote The Wide, Wide World. It's one of the biggest selling books of the 19th century. And it was completely trashed by all of the critics at the time. They just thought it was horrible. And basically, the character is in tears on every page as she's experiencing the wide, wide world. There's, you know, books that we've forgotten now because they don't get archived in our set of canonical texts.
But written, there they were.
By, say, Fanny Fern, who was the highest paid writer in the 19th century American, who had the two biggest bestsellers of the 19th century, and she's just sort of fallen off our cultural map.
Brenda, stand by there in Bloomington, Indiana. Jennifer Posner in New York, what do you think? If we look at 100 years from now, are we going to see reality television as the kind of august art form status that we now give the novel? Does it have the makings of that, Jennifer?
No, I didn't even need the answer to the end of that question to answer no. It's not. I think what people misconstrue about the reality television genre as it's grown in the last 10 years is the depth of deception behind the scenes within the industry. People understand that not everything that they're seeing on reality TV is real, but they don't understand that almost nothing is, and the level of editing and control that producers have from the moment of before casting even begins, from when product placement advertisers are allowed to sit down with producers and influence casting choices, how story arcs are going to play out before they even meet the people, how their products and their ideology through which they sell those products will be built into the master narratives of the shows. There's such deep manipulation with editing, for example, that the industry had to come up with a specific term for it, the Frankenbite, wherein a conversation you may have had, Tom, with your producer on a Monday and with your child on a Wednesday and with your partner on a Sunday could be edited together to make in voiceover, to make it seem like the entire conversation you're having means something entirely different than you meant, was said to a different person, etc.
All faked up. So does it tell us something about our culture then? Or not? Does it tell us nothing? Is it all? If it's, I mean, it could still tell us, I guess, even if it's an utter fiction. But what about it? Is it an important signifier of our culture then or not?
it is an important signifier of what media companies and advertisers want us to believe about our culture. Media companies will say regularly, and reality TV producers will say, that they're just giving the public what they want. They will also say that they're just reflecting what really happened, even if they are editing it down to the most juicy tidbits of what really happened. In fact, they're not giving us what we want. They're giving us what advertisers want. It's 50 to 75% cheaper to make a reality show than a scripted show. And so, therefore, even when reality shows get dismal ratings, they stay on the air longer than scripted shows with higher ratings. And likewise, it is equally a myth that they reflect more than they shape culture. These shows are affecting a political backlash against women's rights and social progress. They're not saying anything about where we are per se. They are saying a lot about what our commercialized media climate wants us to believe, for example, about women. And
you're saying
that's
not just an angle, that is the angle, that is the point of reality TV going after women?
I don't think it's the only point, but I think it has functioned that way in many, many cases over the last 10 years. Overarchingly, if you look at reality television's narratives about women, from relationship shows to lifestyle shows to competition shows to makeover shows to, you know, sort of the celebutante sitting around doing nothing shows, all of them have portrayed overarchingly women as stupid, ditzy bimbos. These are all this is all language that is used on the programs, not my language. They've presented women as catty, manipulative divas, not to be trusted. I know we're not allowed to say the B word, but that word is thrown around constantly on every show about women. They're women of color in particular are portrayed as hypersexual, promiscuous, ignorant, and violent. And then once 2006 came around, the typecasting and tokenism of people of color on network reality shows changed with added diversity when Flavor of Love came on the scene, but then that revived the modern minstrel show where people of color began being portrayed as basically thugs and criminals or buffoons and clowns for the men and, you know, basically ignorant, hypersexual Jezebels for the women.
Oh, my gosh.
It's very clearly political, and it's what I want to get across is that this is not so much a reflection of American culture as an attempt by commercial media to resurrect incredibly regressive and outdated social and political norms.
There's your past, Khalifa, and Jennifer lays it all out there. And stupid, ditzy, you know, catty, manipulative, violent, ignorant, Jezebel, you name it. Brenda Weber, when you look at this, do you see it that way? Is that what jumps out at you? First of all, do you see it as purely a manipulated offering, as Jennifer describes, and as kind of regressive demeaning, as she describes?
I won't deny that all of those elements are present, but I don't see it as the primary characteristic of reality TV more broadly, because I think that reality TV has a much broader set of narratives than that one mainstream. That's definitely present, and you can find it there if you're looking for it. But I think, I mean, one of the things that people often ask me is, how did you possibly manage to watch that much reality TV to write my book? And one of the things you have to do is get past your gag reflex, a kind of immediate response to this, particularly when you're a feminist.
Why get past it? What's there if you overcome
everything
it?
That Jennifer said is present. Everything that she said is
no, but
there.
I mean,
but there's more there, too.
So it's worth getting past that to see what?
Well, from my point of view, you can find out a lot about what sort of larger investments are, what's at stake, what are we afraid of, what do we keep having to learn, why do we need all of these reminders that our femininity or our masculinity is at risk, why do we need to be told so often that, you know, a harsh woman like Kate Gosselin on John and Kate Plus 8 is shrewish, or I mean, honestly, she's more Shakespearean than Shakespeare sometimes. Mm-hmm. But it seems to me that once we get past that sort of immediate, oh my gosh, these are incredibly misogynistic and homophobic and commercialized and commodity-driven sorts of texts, and we start thinking about, but what else are we seeing here? And I think it is a sort of moment of great ambivalence within the broader culture of what to do about women with more power, with more desire, but also with aging bodies. There's a way in which these shows are reflecting back a series of concerns that many of us are going through. And I agree with Jennifer that they are about what advertisers want, but I don't think that means that advertisers don't want to know what we want, right? I think there's still more circularity involved in advertising. So we can't just leave it at they're trying to sell us product. Because if we do, then there's a whole lot more going on that we're just not analyzing.
Let's get our listeners in here. Nashville, Tennessee, Dorit is calling. Hi, Dorit. You're on the air. Thanks for calling.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
Yeah, I was just calling in because in the last few years, when as long as reality television has become really big. I've lived in Miami and now Nashville, Tennessee, and these are two places where you actually see a lot of these reality stars kind of after the fact.
On the street? You mean just around town?
Yeah, on the street, around
unsupervised.
Town.
Unsupervised?
Unsupervised, unfilmed. What's that like, Dorit? Are they genuine celebrities or just, they had their 15 minutes of fame and now they're just getting groceries?
Sometimes people look at them a lot. Yesterday, I was actually at the gym, and I saw an American Idol star from a few seasons ago. And I almost wanted to go up to him and say, oh, you've lost a lot of weight or something. And then I checked myself. I was like, well, I don't know this person. I would never say that to a stranger in any other setting. And it's very bizarre.
They really walk bizarre. Among us. Caliph, I mean, this is one of the things about this. You're creating these stories and stars out of it, yet so many that they're kind of all over the place. I mean, this is sort of 15 minutes of fame territory, though some pick it up and go right on with it. They're both, short-term subjects, but then, maybe they make a big career out of this little appearance, Caliph.
Well, yeah, I mean, television has always been about creating this obviously kind of false sense of intimacy between those of us who are watching and those people who are on TV. And by kind of greatly expanding the number of people that are on TV and the number of people who could be considered in some sense celebrities, reality TV has made this relationship a little more of a two-way relationship. And so, on a show like American Idol, it's a great example because this is someone who is a celebrity partly because they've been picked by producers to be on American Idol, but partly because they've been picked by viewers to stay on American Idol. One of the interesting things about the American Idol model is that the judges on that show don't really have much power. They can kind of give their opinion, but it's the people who vote in. And so, if you see one of these people on the street and you think on some sense that you created this star, there's a slight but real sense in which that's true. And I think the people on reality TV have gotten a lot more savvy and sophisticated with how they can deploy their own celebrity and what they want out of it. They're not, the members of the Loud family were kind of blinking in the bright lights when it was all over because they had no idea how it was going to change their lives. A young person who goes on The Real World today probably goes on with a full media plan and ideas about how they want to leverage that kind of fame. And I think as viewers, we've also gotten more comfortable with the idea that these are quote-unquote real people who are also in some non-trivial sense celebrities. And the idea that you can be both things at once is a complicated thing, I think, for viewers to think through.
So many people just make that grab for freedom. So what have you done today to make you feel proud?
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about reality television, what it tells us about ourselves, from Survivor to Extreme Makeover to American Idol, Teen Mom, and all the way down the great big list that has increasingly dominated American television in the last decade. Caliph Hassani is with us, staff writer for The New Yorker. His big article last week was The Reality Principle, the rise and rise of a television genre. You can link to it through our website, onpointradio.org. Terrific piece. Jennifer Posner is with us from New York. She's author of Reality Bites Back, The Troubling Truth About Guilty Pleasure TV. And from Bloomington, Indiana, Brenda Weber is here, professor of gender studies there, expert scholar in Victorian literature, author of Makeover TV, and the forthcoming Gender vision. Here's a little bit from Extreme Makeover, ABC from 2002 to 2007, a typical surgery. This is a plastic surgery makeover. Here's one wish list.
And here's LaPaula's dream surgery. A brow lift, lip repositioning, upper and lower eyelid lift, chin implant, liposuction, bigger breasts, tummy tuck, and later, perfect vision and a stunning new smile.
And what do we have when all that's over? Maybe that's the question. Here's a little bit from VH1. Flavor of Love ran from 06 to 08, a spoof in a way on The Bachelor. Female contestants, mostly minority, are competing to win the heart of the rapper Flavor Flav from Public Enemy. Here's second season. Contestants are tasked with cleaning up hip-hop artist Warren G's home, which has been trashed.
I want to know that a girl can keep my house clean.
So the girls
went up in this spot. I went in the limo.
Oh, my God. I walked in the door. I thought a bomb hit the house. It was like a tornado.
Jennifer Posner, all Flavor Flav wants to know is if a girl can clean up a house.
Well, you know, it's interesting. The one thing that we need to understand about dating shows in reality TV over the last 10 years, for the first 6 years of dating shows on network television, we were conditioned to understand the quest for true love equals one white Prince Charming and 25 or 20 or 15, depending on the series, desperate, pathetic, single, pretty white women who say things like, I will die alone if he doesn't pick me, and who have no ambition. But it's all wrapped up in this sort of fuzzy, pretty fairy tale language about Prince Charming and living in castles and dressing adult people in Cinderella ball gowns and sweeping them off to Aruba or, you know, France for exotic dream dates. Meanwhile, Flavor of Love comes on the scene in 2006, and it portrays the quest for a relationship not as so much true love as some weird version of it in which women who are in their 20s are competing to date a haggard ex-drug addict who's about twice their age, and they're all expected to compete in contests to win dates, not that he chooses them based on if he likes them, compete in contests. And the contests, because they're all women of color, the contests are extremely racialized. So whereas white women get to play Cinderella on The Bachelor and Joe Millionaire and et cetera, Black women and Latinas and Asian women get to play maids on Flavor of Love. Mm. They get to have booty dance-off contests. They get to sling burgers in fast food restaurants to see who's going to win basically a date to romantic locations like Kentucky Fried Chicken. So, you know, it's not like this is any kind of reflection of where we are as Americans. It's a reflection, as I said earlier, of what advertisers want us to believe. If you knew nothing about American culture other than what you saw on reality TV, you'd believe the women's movement and the civil rights movement never happened.
Califa, why would reality TV be so driven, if Jennifer's right, to sort of take us back in every which way? Back to minstrel shows and maids and Cinderella stories. I mean, it could go in any direction. Why back?
Well, I think it's a couple of things. One, I think partly a show like Flavor of Love is a continuation of this tradition that you saw in the 1990s, where you had a series of African-American sitcoms on smaller networks like UPN and WB. And even though these were scripted shows, the discussion was kind of the same. Is this minstrelsy or is this broad stereotypes? Is this kind of burlesque humor? Is this offensive? Is this too close to blackface entertainment? I mean, I saw – and again, part of what I loved about – you know, Flavor of Love when it was good was that it kind of did all these things at once. In the first episode, you see Flavor Flav sticking out of a limousine shouting, I'm the Black Shriller. And that kind of set the tone that part of what
sending
it did,
it
one
up.
Of the,
yeah.
Well, one of the many things that it did, yeah, was kind of take these sort of like these happy princessy dreams of a show like The Bachelor and sort of puncture them. And it's this that maid scene is an incredibly complicated scene because there are all those stereotypes of the black maid, but part of what the scene is about is that these women are not people who would do this, who want to do this, who would ever do this. And so
they're cleaning up a black rapper's mansion.
Well, you know, Tom, you asked about why. Why the regressiveness? Why taking us back? Why, if this is a reality genre, why could we not just either reflect actual people's experiences or, for example, why could we not
pay it
reflect
forward?
Exactly. A more forward-thinking, so, progressive vision.
Yeah.
Here's the answer. It is no surprise that these kinds of images are so deeply regressive when product placement advertisers are setting the tone with producers. Advertising has always depicted, for, you know, more than 100 years, women as being worthless if they're not stereotypically beautiful and
thin,
etc. Why is
that good? Why? So they can sell beauty creams and...
Beauty creams and you know, hair and clothes and the beauty and cosmetics industry, but it's fashion. But it's also, you know, they've produced years and years and years of violent advertising, selling everything from shoes to cars, women dead in trunks. The cultural critic, media critic Gene Kilbourne, mm-hmm. has done extremely amazing, intense work on this over the last 40 years. It's a subject for another conversation.
But I mean, it sells to go backwards, sells more product. That's got to be the bottom line for them.
It's not that it necessarily does, but there's a in the chapter in my book called "The World According to CoverGirl," I answer this question about why the concept for advertisers is that if you create insecurities among the consumer, then the product comes in and pretends to be able to fill the gap, to solve the insecurity, to fix the problem that they've told us we have. But it's not just a commercial impulse. It's also an ideological impulse. So it's not, when I say it's no surprise because we've seen the kind of racism in, depicting women of color as hypersexual or as animalistic in these reality shows. We've seen that in advertising for years.
Can I speak to this for a second?
If I can go to Brenda for a second. I mean, Brenda, it's interesting. Yeah. You've got a little more glass half full here. It's not all regressive. You see people, women, I guess most commonly here, able to, in a way, propel themselves forward, especially in these makeover shows. They have a shot at something new, different, better, perhaps.
Yeah, I actually want to make 2 points. I think one is to go back earlier to ways of thinking about reality celebrity. There are a lot of ways that we might look at the participation on reality TV as a savvy set of strategies for getting what you want. So one of the people that I've actually gotten to know was a participant on The Biggest Loser Season 2. She lives near where I do in Indiana. And she was approached by the state of Indiana to take part in this new Get Healthy Indiana campaign.
Okay.
And they didn't offer her to pay her any money. And then they invited her the next year. And by that time, she realized, wow, I've got something to sell here, which is my celebrity.
Mm-hmm.
And was able to really change her material circumstances and that of her family because she recognized she had a commodity to sell. But going back to this idea of flavor of love, I think that one of the things we have to realize is these shows don't get produced in a vacuum and they don't get seen in a vacuum. And I have the distinct advantage of having watched these shows with 100 of my students at any given time.
Yep.
And they'll watch scenes that are outrageous, and they know they're outrageous, and they're resisting them actively. And I think particularly when shows are on... When shows are on MTV or when they're on VH1, there's a form of hyperbole and critique that's loaded into them from the very beginning as a way to set up the parody that's being played out. It doesn't mean that there aren't still disturbing stereotypes at play. The other thing that's interesting in terms of Flavor of Love is that the women who weren't selected, you know, for the dubious honor mm-hmm. of being his girlfriend for that week, went on to compete in a different show, also on VH1, called Monique's Charm School.
Charm School, yeah.
Yeah, and Charm School, again, had a series of egregious stereotypes, but they were so egregious that they were comedic. And I think it was evident as we were watching that it wasn't really about, you know, trying to fit them to this ideal of the charming young lady. And many of those lessons were actually about how to get more celebrity conscious. So Florida, who was one of the big winners because she got her own show, kind of like Sarah Palin, ends up being engaged in a what if you are interviewed by a hostile reporter? How do you handle yourself, right?
So preparing
me,
for celebrity,
exactly.
Stepping
well,
on
but
up.
It's also how does one deport oneself in a larger frame? And that, to me, is a fascinating set of lessons that actually begin to pull reality TV together in a different kind of way.
I have been so bad to listeners. So many waiting here. Let me bring a couple in. I'm sorry. Bill, New Haven, Connecticut. I got lost in the music. Bill, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Listen, I'm a retired professor of 19th and 20th century dramatic literature, realism, naturalism, and then some of the movements that followed. So that's my
Great.
Bias.
Yeah.
But in 19th century naturalism started in France and then in Germany, they had a phrase called tranche de vie, which means a slice of life.
Yes.
The difference between the 19th century theater that says, okay, this is real life, is that it was all accepted as an art form. It brought together all of the components necessary for theater to be perceived of in a different way.
So are we just failing to recognize an art form in reality TV? Is that what you're saying, Bill, or the opposite?
We're saying it's a snake, and you're saying it's an orange, and it's not. It's a banana.
It's in fact, is it art or not, Bill? A new art form or not? Is Margaret Mead wrong?
It is not an art form. MTV is an art form. If they want to sell this as a here's a deal, the way commercials, nobody is fooled about. I'm playing a doctor on TV. Even that commercial that got whipped around. We all know that so and so is a car salesman, but he's really Joe Schmitz who works down the street.
But didn't they also know that in France with your tranche de vie, your slice of life? They knew it was just a play. It was just on stage.
Well, first of all, it had all of the. Sorry. It's allergy season here in New Haven.
Here
too. It had all of the components of what a play is. And reality TV, when you see these people swimming with alligators or having to eat bugs and then go to their air-conditioned tent and have Chablis and Brie, they shouldn't call it that. They should call it a different name. And just because everybody's studying it doesn't mean that it's real art.
Bill, I appreciate your call. Let me get one more. Kristen in Baltimore. Kristen, you're on the air. Thanks for calling.
Thanks, Tom. Thank you for taking my call. Mm-hmm. One of the things I think is interesting is how reality TV medium has moved from being ostensibly a sociological experiment or guilty pleasure experience to more directly political. I'm thinking, of course, of Donald Trump or Sarah Palin, who's been mentioned
yes.
a couple times, using their shows to launch their political platforms.
Yeah.
I'd love the guests to comment on this and talk about where they think we're heading as we enter the 2012 presidential races.
That's
and I'll
great.
My comment
Tom,
here. Thank
yeah,
you.
And I see here
Tom,
Bristol Palin getting a new show on moving from Alaska to Los Angeles, but what about the intersection politics and reality TV, Jennifer?
I think that that's a very, very prescient question. We heard earlier in the hour a clip of Obama talking about reality TV kind of bleeding into politics,
mm-hmm.
seeping in.
Mm-hmm.
And we just saw in this past year the first ever reality series that was executive produced by a former vice presidential candidate and some say future presidential candidate, allowing Sarah Palin on TLC with Sarah Palin's Alaska
mm-hmm.
to completely ignore and flout political campaign spending and regulations around television time. She was an executive producer of that show, which most people don't understand when they're watching the difference between a reality star and a reality star who was also a producer. That was, I think, 8 episodes allowing a candidate to totally brand herself and frame herself, her family, her values in whatever way that she could stay on point. So you saw episodes in which she would use some of the same phrases
she
used on the campaign trail about Mama Grizzlies or don't retreat, just reload. She'd say the same things that she'd say. We saw her filming a Fox News debate. We saw her, doing basically akin to snuff films for the NRA. It was absolutely the most effective political ad I've ever seen. And yet at the same time, you know, totally ruining any traditional understanding of gravitas a candidate may have had.
Kelepha, you've looked so much at this, and we could go on for another hour. I wish we could here, but where do you come away, Kelepha? End of Western civilization, new art form, both?
Well, I think the debates about whether it's an art form kind of always turn on our definition of art form. I think whatever it is, you know, it's something that we find compelling, and I think we find it compelling for a wide variety of reasons, and I don't think that's likely to change. One thing that the rise of reality has taught us is that we as viewers can watch and enjoy and be riveted by stories that are a little messier than the stories we're used to seeing on scripted TV, and morals that are a little harder to discern. You sit down and you watch an hour, and you can't figure out what exactly it is you learned, and that thing, that quest of trying to figure out what the story is, who the characters are, is, I think, part of what we love about it, those of us that love it.
Well, we may not have figured out who we are from reality TV in this hour quite yet either, but we've got some good angles on it, and I'm grateful for those. Kelefasane, first for your article in The New Yorker and for being with us. Thank you very much for joining us today.
Thank you.
Jennifer Posner, author of Reality Bites Back. Jennifer, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you, Tom.
And Brenda Weber at Indiana University, author of Makeover TV. Thanks for being with us, Brenda.
Sure, a pleasure. Thanks.
We'll go out with a little more. It Goes On and On. James Durbin from American Idol. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Thanks for joining us.
Maybe I'm amazed at the way you help me sing my song. Maybe I'm afraid.